Okay, real talk. How many pictures are on your camera roll right now? Enough to induce a little stress? Let's take a deep breath.
Friend to friend, I want to tell you what finally worked for me. Chatbooks. They make it so easy to actually do something with all those photos.
And right now, they're giving us a podcast exclusive mind-blowing offer. 12 monthly mini photo books for just $12, plus free shipping. That's a full year of printed memories for less than you pay for 1 month of streaming. Sleep better at night knowing your memories are safe. Just pick your photos and the Chatbooks app does the rest. Go to chatbooks.com/get12. That's chatbooks.com/get12 and grab this deal before it's gone.
Show, and I am extremely excited today to have Kelly Vallejos returning to the show. Not only does she always have fantastic insights and helps us break down the current events, but she has a really great new article at antiwar.com that I can't wait to discuss with her. Kelly, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me back on the show.
Absolutely, Kelly. I get you on just about as much as I feel like I could take your time.
So anytime.
All right. Some subjects I want to talk to you about today: Trump, Rubio, and America First, the missile problem, and can Trump control Netanyahu? So first up here is Venezuela, and you have this new article, fantastic article, breaking down the situations. The neocons have finally found a way into MAGA hearts. So, Kelly, how is it that suddenly we seem to have lost MAGA with Trump? So kind of what is going on with the American right here?
Yeah, no, I find this very alarming. And I know, having written about neocons since the Iraq War, before the Iraq War, that it's very easy to get into this sort of rhetorical space where you're constantly blaming neocons for everything, and they're behind every bush and every tree waiting to leap out and contaminate our foreign policy. I do think this is different. I say that because after Trump won the 2016 election, a lot of your key neocons like Bill Kristol and Elliot Cohen, Jen Rubin, David Frum, and others became never Trumpers. And they sort of fled the scene. They spent most of their time dedicated to criticizing Donald Trump writ large, not just his foreign policy. They could not even hold the nose to go work for him. They signed letters saying they would never work for the Trump administration. So they were sort of out of it. And so the neocons self-selected out of the Trump administration foreign policy. Now, and probably for good reason, because the Trump administration had declared that it was not interested in regime change wars and interventions to spread democracy and freedom and liberty across the globe. They were done with the wars of the 2000s, that 20 years worth. And so they didn't really see a space for themselves anyway. And then come 2022, during the Biden administration, they sort of hopped on that bandwagon against Russia and feeding and fueling the war in Ukraine, which divided, again, the Trump administration and the Republicans, particularly MAGA, were not so much interested in fueling that war because they saw a part of the Russiagate conspiracy or smear against Trump. So, as you know, for every Democrat that came out and said we have to give Ukraine everything that it needed to finish the war and get Russia out of its country, a MAGA person saw that as sort of code for, getting rid of the Trumpies and the MAGA. And, you know, if you don't agree, you're for autocracies. It became a very politicized war here in the United States. And it still is to a certain extent. So neocons really couldn't get in on that. They basically saw this as the just war. They always hated Russia. You can go back to Victoria Nuland and all of her democracy promotion efforts. So, you know, they didn't see a space for neocons or neoconservative thinking in that war. And so Trump is elected. Gaza comes around. MAGA starts getting split over Israel. And you see that continuing to this day. Real skepticism over what are the U.S. interests in that war. And that has really sent tidal waves through the conservative, and particularly the new right space, for the first time questioning this fealty to Israel. So again, neocons on the out again. Then comes Venezuela. And Rubio, who finds himself in a super powerful position in the administration, wearing both hats of the Secretary of State, as well as the National Security Advisor, the head of the National Security Council, is an old-time regime changer who came into his own as a neoconservative when he was elected in 2011. All of his donors from his Florida days all were from neoconservative spaces. He comes in and now he gets to see this regime change that he's wanted in Cuba and Nicaragua and Venezuela realize. So what does he do? He looks at the space, the MAGA space. He sees, you know, the language and the rhetoric of the Trump administration is more Jacksonian. It's more about non-regime change. You know, when we're attacked, you know, we'll hit you hard, twice as hard. He finds a way to work in the sort of national conservatism, that sort of Jacksonian rhetoric into his regime change agenda. And so therefore you have neocons who are now starting to creep back in and using the rhetoric of strength in the hemisphere, this neo-Monroe doctrine, thinking or reorganization of our foreign policy to be more about U.S. interests, protecting the homeland, and saying, see, well, one of the things that we have to do to accomplish all that is regime change in Venezuela. And so I find that very concerning because I feel this is the first time that neoconservatives can find a way to push a wedge between the MAGA adherents and those realists within that coalition in terms of like getting support for a regime change war at the expense of all the lessons that we learned about what regime change does and why we needed to take a more realist foreign policy under the Trump administration in the first place. And I'm sorry if I was long-winded on that one.
No, brilliant answer, Kelly. And I guess, you know, my follow-up and the question, I guess, what I see is on Israel and Ukraine, you can argue that Trump is trying to implement, you know, he's trying to get the war stopped in Gaza. We could say he's not doing an effective job of it. He's not, you know, he's made some steps on Ukraine towards rolling back U.S. support. And we could kind of see the Trumpian style art of the deal that I think we expected on Ukraine, where he's making these threats towards Russia. He's increasing some support here and there for Ukraine to try to increase pressure on Russia to make a deal. Mm-hmm. I think it's a miscalculation. I think it's a bad policy. But I do understand how that fits into the art of the deal in Trump's foreign policy, and It's frankly what I expected to happen. When it comes to Venezuela, it's a little bit more surprising to me because, again, this seems like a needless regime change war. It seems obvious that if you attack the cartels, not only are they going to, find ways to smuggle drugs still, but also they're very capable of carrying out asymmetric kind of attacks in the United States or targeting Americans, the millions of them in Latin and South America. But most of all, it's going to create a massive immigration and migration crisis. Even if the Venezuelans don't make it to the U.S., if they, say, start going north to Panama and other countries, it's going more destabilization. More people are going to end up in at American borders because of this. So it seems quite shocking that Donald Trump has been willing to go as far as he's willing to go here. Have you been surprised by that as well?
I am surprised. And I think a lot of this can be explained by the amount of power that Marco Rubio has been given within the White House. And I can't emphasize enough. You go into an administration like Trump does, you engage DOGE and you start cutting up these agencies, you start, firing people, letting them go, reorganizing. And, as much as I and I'm sure many people watching right now appreciate the effort to really start getting under the hood with the deep state and getting rid of a lot of dead wood, a lot of agenda driven bureaucrats who have been there for decades and decades. I'm all for that. But I think what happened is that you end up upending two major foreign policy realms, the National Security Council and the State Department. And you put somebody like Marco Rubio, who's very smart, very well connected, and has a serious agenda that I don't think jibes with the Trump foreign policy of realism and restraint. I'm not saying that Trump is all about realism and restraint. I'm saying that's part of his coalition. And I don't think that Marco Rubio ever bought into that. People disagree with me. People on the right believe that Marco Rubio has made an authentic turn towards a more Jacksonian foreign policy. I have yet to see the evidence of that. So you put somebody like that in charge with an agenda, and then you marginalize anybody that has some dissenting point of view, or those people have been shuttered, laid off, transferred, whatever. And then you have a predominant voice. And I do believe that Marco Rubio has, because he's very savvy, didn't get to where he is today without being pretty astute, has the ear of President Trump and convinces him in language that he understands. And I believe it's more Cold War oriented. He says, hey, this guy is a socialist. He's a dictator. He's not only that, he's a drug kingpin. And we need to get rid of him. He is a poison for the region and our homeland. And not only is he sending drugs, but he is he's creating a situation where we can't extend our influence and have trade and yada, yada. I mean, whatever the language is, it is more Cold War oriented than it is neoconservative. But he knows that that's what Trump buys into. And yeah. I feel like he has a way of, I don't want to say manipulating, that might be too strong, but influencing the president to convince him that this is the way to go. It's not necessarily the old regime change wars of the 2000s, but a way to protect the homeland and increase our influence in our backyard.
So, I think you make a really important observation there that Marco Rubio is actually smart. I would always call him stupid. I watched him run for president the first time. I've seen him do interviews. He doesn't seem to really understand conflicts and situations around the world, but that doesn't mean he isn't a very effective operator in Washington, D.C. And when you look at the Trump administration, when it was coming in, there were people around the president who aren't people that I would put in my administration, but are people who I thought could direct the president's foreign policy in the right direction. Rick Grenell, Tulsi Gabbard, Vice President J.D. Vance, even Steve Witkoff to some extent. And largely, I think what we've seen is I mean, Tulsi, I guess it's hard to say a DNI on the very public Iran thing. She obviously failed. J.D. Vance, I'm not quite sure the influence of him, but from reporting I read from Sagar and Jetty and Ryan Grimm, the kind of Florida, the group of Floridian Republicans in the administration, Susie Wiles, Pam Bondi, Marco Rubio, Donald Trump himself, are kind of dominating the administration at this point. And so I'm just wondering what are your insights on how the administration is operating, how foreign policy is being determined. I mean, it seems like maybe a pretty good indicator is that Rick Grenell has been entirely sidelined on the Venezuelan issue when he actually had a successful meeting with Maduro earlier on. And Marco Rubio has been elevated to seemingly the role decision maker on this issue.
Okay, you're going to freak out at this deal. Chatbooks is giving you 12 monthly mini photo books for just $12, plus free shipping. It's the easiest way to finally do something with all those photos on your phone. Finally. No stress, no hassle, just memories made easy. Go to chatbooks.com/get12. That's chatbooks.com/get12 before this deal disappears.
Absolutely. And, you know, the Miami Herald had a great piece on this, who talked about what they called it a trifecta. I can't remember what the reporter said, but it was more like indicating that J.D. Vance, Marco Rubio, and Susie Wiles were sort of like this trifecta, for lack of a better word, who had enormous power within the inner circle of Donald Trump, Donald Trump's White House, but also two out of the three are very much influencing our foreign policy. And I'm sure Susie is too, because she's at all of these high level meetings. And most people don't even know who she is. But where does that, you know, where does that leave Hegseth? I think Hegseth's just sort of like doing what he's told over there in the Pentagon, which is really scary. I think that he probably felt like he's on a razor's edge in terms of whether he's on the ins or outs with Trump at any given moment, after all of the follies of the early part of the year with the, you know, the signal chats, and, you know, he's just stumbling and bumbling through the job. And so Trump is kind of keeping him in there, but sort of like, okay, you're just going to do what you're told. And Rick Grenell, as you mentioned, had been sidelined. I've heard that Director Radcliffe at the CIA is very influential as well in this Venezuela policy, at least. And Stephen Miller is also super influential. And from what I've heard, has a lot of authority within the Trump administration on the Venezuelan policy. So all fingers are pointing not to a good place in terms of having a more restrained or realist foreign policy. I believe that Marco Rubio's authority also, as you know, the two hats that he holds, extends to the Ukraine policy, in which he and Keith Kellogg seem to be quite influential. And as you can see, that effort to get peace there and get both sides of the table is flailing as well, mostly because I think that Trump is getting some bad advice on how he should be reacting to Putin at any given moment. And I'm sorry if that means that, you know, I think that means, you know, likely that Rubio and Kellogg are front and center on that policy too. So it doesn't make me feel very confident that things are going to go in a very positive direction on either of them.
Yeah. No, I mean, fantastic point there. Now, Kelly, I guess one, maybe answer this too. How far will we escalate in Venezuela? But one problem getting there seems to be the facts don't back up the claims. You know, everybody knows that fentanyl doesn't come from Venezuela. It comes from Mexico. Everybody knows that Venezuela isn't a major hub of drone trafficking to the U.S. It comes up the West Coast, up the Pacific Ocean. And then, you know, even the U.S. intelligence community, I think I read this in The Atlantic, Nancy Youssef was saying that they don't believe that Maduro is the kingpin of any of the narco-terrorist organizations. So do the facts get in the way of a war? And do you think that we are going to war with Venezuela, whether that be land strikes inside Venezuela, full-on regime change, or even as Lindsey Graham has recently floated, putting troops on the ground?
Kyle, I don't know. Some people think that perhaps the president will be putting so much military pressure on Maduro that he will leave on his own will and be secreted off somewhere to Russia, and Maria Machado will come in as the puppet regime of the United States, a bloodless coup, in other words. You know, for something like that to happen, you would have to have the Venezuelan military turn against Maduro. And I haven't seen, and I've tried to talk to a few people today about this, I haven't seen any indication that the Venezuelan military is going to cave. That's not to say it's not going to happen. I mean, we are marshaling a lot of firepower in the region. As you know, they just sent the Gerald Ford carrier group down there on Friday. We look like we are marshaling our resources for war. But it could be what Trump likes to say, a maximum pressure campaign. Or it could be that he starts launching airstrikes against specific targets in Venezuela, which would also be part of a pressure campaign against Maduro and the military there. But as you know, Congress has not been briefed on this. Congress has not been asked to approve this. Congress has not been asked to pass an authorization for military force. You got people like Rand Paul out there, beating the drum saying, hey, wait a minute, these strikes are illegal. They haven't been explained fully to the American people, and I'm not going to support a regime change. I'm so glad that we have a Rand Paul, but we need more Rand Pauls. I mean, outside of that, I've only seen Marjorie Taylor Greene and Todd Young on the Republican side, and a few folks like Adam Schiff and Tim Kaine. There's so much wrong with what's going on right now. And it's sad that the administration has not, tried to justify this to the American people. You have Marco Rubio out there, and basically what he's doing is a little, sleight of hand. He talks about like, this is all in U.S. interests, but it's not a regime change. But what he's saying is that Maduro is drug kingpin. They put a $50 million bounty on his head and said that he has to be brought to justice. Well, that sounds to me that like either he goes or not. We're not just talking about cartels here. We're talking about getting rid of the president of Venezuela because we say he is not legitimate. I can't tell you how many times Rubio has said that. So we go right back to this, the neocon sleight of hand. I think I'm going to start calling it that from now on. On one hand, they say this is not regime change. And on the other hand, they say, but he's got to go because he's the head of a cartel.
Yeah. So, Kelly, I know this takes us beyond the scope of your article a little bit, but there already seems to be a lot of tension, not only among the Republicans, but particularly Trump's base. And a lot of this agitation has been around the issue of Israel, where even Marjorie Taylor Greene has been an outspoken critic and other members of Congress who have been a little bit critical of the Israel policy. But particularly among the base, you hear a lot of people very upset with Trump's Israel policy. Now, I'm thinking that if he, really goes against the American first principle and attacks Venezuela, you could see that fracture turn into a real split. And so I guess if Trump does get co-opted and moves in this real neocon direction, unlimited support for Israel, unable or unwilling to end the proxy war in Ukraine, and I think most importantly, a war, a regime change war, a disaster in our own hemisphere, based on lies, a policy driven by the Republican elites that the base simply does not want, what happens to the Republican Party?
I one of the things that has really bothered me about this from the beginning is that, somebody like Marco Rubio come in, change the language, that these neocons can co-opt the language of national conservatism. So If you remember in 2016, the National Conservatism Conference was launched by Yoram Hazony, who is an Israeli nationalist. And a lot of folks, you know, in our orbit had said, this sounds a little neocon-y, you know, like, all, you know, what's going on here? And, you know, I've covered several of these National Conservatism Conference, and they aren't very foreign policy heavy. They are mostly domestic politics, like mostly about the culture war, I would say. I think that neocons are very savvy, and they said, you know what, we're not getting anywhere with the old democracy promotion, you know, like protecting Israel, all that, you know, BS from the 90s and the 2000s. You know, we're going to convince people that, you know, national conservatism can mean many different things. And it can mean at certain level, protecting the hemisphere. Now, most Republicans and MAGA would say, were really kind of, you know, brought into the fold over immigration and restricting the borders and making sure those drugs and terrible people don't come in over the borders. But at some point, it's shifted to, cartels, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua. And I think, you know, that conditioning of national conservatism and protecting the homeland and having certain voices within that realm, basically pushing, there was an easy shift to Venezuela. Maduro is the bad guy, not because so much, and, you know, MAGA doesn't care really that he didn't, you know, he might have fixed an election. They don't give two craps about that. But if you tell them that he's feeding our streets with drugs, that he's sending gang members into our streets, that's a different story. And I think that they've been very effective of that. Now, what will that do to the party if they push that wedge and Trump goes in the direction that he said he'd never would do? Man, I don't know, Kyle. The good thing is that you have social media and you have people like Tucker Carlson, for example, like what you're doing on this show, who are hammering it. Marjorie Taylor Greene, I mean, she's priceless because she's relentless in pointing out the hypocrisy and pointing out the bad faith actors who are floating around there and whispering all these regime change promises and bombing this country and bombing that country. And they're constantly pointing out, this is not what we voted for. This is not America first. So I think that the best thing that we can do is to keep having these conversations and say, no, you don't own MAGA. You don't own America first. You know, you don't own Trump. You know, there will be a battle. And we're not going to go quietly into the night like we did. I mean, not that we went quietly in the night, but a lot of people were just shut up and marginalized during the Iraq war. And we're just not going to do it this time.
Yeah, no, it's a fantastic point. And there's, you know, so many influencers in the culture and the conversation when you're on Edsom on the right is certainly breaking with Trump on his foreign policy. But not only that, there are, you know, real and important outlets like the American Conservative that is very critical of Donald Trump on a day-to-day basis over his foreign policy while praising him for things that he does right. But, you know, they are really trying to hold Trump accountable. And so not only is there like a cultural and, you know, some political leadership in this in that part of the Republican Party, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Thomas Massey, Rand Paul, but also intellectuals behind it, which I think is going to, you know, maybe propel it forward and really, if not a full-on split from the Republican Party, a real civil war and internal battle coming up in 2028 to see kind of which direction they go when it comes to foreign policy. Now, another really important outlet is the Quincy Institute, where you are the editorial director. And there is a very, very, very important article at the Quincy Institute today, Inflating Russian Missile Costs Hides U.S. Weapons Crisis. And what this article does is it goes in and it breaks down, Kelly, the cost of American versus Russian missiles. And even when the Russians are outperforming the American missiles are costing 3, 4, 10, 15 times as much as their Russian counterparts. And I think this should be a really shining light, particularly to the Republicans, that it's just simply not financially, logistically feasible to do everything the Trump administration is talking about doing. We could defend Israel from Iran. We could at least fuel the proxy war in Ukraine. We could at least kind of defend Taiwan from China or wage a war against Venezuela. But it seems absolutely incomprehensible looking at the numbers in this article to do all those things. So I guess, you know, kind of what do you make of these dynamics, Kelly? How much trouble is like the U.S. really in? If we were to get into a real war, it seems like it's just an absolute financial train wreck.
Yeah, I don't think we know the actual depth of how much trouble we are in because we don't have access to the numbers. So whenever we put out a story on responsible statecraft or, you know, you see pieces in the Wall Street Journal on this often, you know, a lot of it's piecing together like publicly sourced information on, you know, how much we have used and depleted in Ukraine, the war against the Houthis and the Red Sea, as well as all the missile defense that we provided to Israel since 2023. So it's a piecing together game, and then you piece together how much it would cost to, you know, replenish all of those stocks and how much time it would take. And just on the publicly sourced information, it looks pretty grim. And I think what you're seeing in the story that you presented that by Michael Friedenberg today is that from the very beginning, there has been obviously an information war going on with lots of propaganda from the get-go with the Ukraine-Russia war. And one of the things that the Western press has hammered away at is this idea that Russia cannot sustain this war, whether it be the sanctions are hurting them, that they don't have enough men to fight. Now, in this piece, it's the talk of how expensive their weapons are and how they can't keep up from all their expenditures in the war. And really, you know, what he's trying to say in this piece is that it's really a deflection, because we know separately that the sanctions have not hurt the Russians as expected, you know, that they have never mobilized their population for war. So they have plenty of men. And when you look at the costs for similar missiles, particularly defense missiles or the interceptors for Russia and the U.S., the U.S. is spending millions more per missile than the Russians. And most of it is because they have cheaper steel, cheaper titanium. They have lower labor costs. And the United States defense industry is not only broken, but it is actually counterproductive and dysfunctional at this point. So we can't replenish any of these missiles, in a timely nature to actually help the Ukrainians, and B, we're running through money like you would not believe, mostly because we're not efficient, and the defense industry is all about profits and returning, you know, benefits to the shareholders. And so you see constant over costs, delays. I mean, we can go on and on, but the idea that Russia is in trouble, you know, it's just another deflection, more propaganda to make us feel a little better, or not us, but, you know, to project this idea that, you know, they're losing, Ukraine is winning, victories are right around the corner. And what Michael is saying in this piece is like, you know, it's right around the corner, is like we could get into a real war and we would not be prepared because we've depleted all of our stockpiles and we don't have the wherewithal. We don't have the industrial base to actually get it going to the point where we could defend ourselves. That's what's right around the corner, thanks to these wars that are still ongoing, sadly.
Yeah. Well, absolutely brilliant analysis today, Kelly. Thank you so much for coming back on the show. Of course, I will have you back on in the near future. Think about anytime you write something for antiwar.com, yes. I'll have you on, but maybe even more frequently than that. Your insights are always so appreciated here. So before I let you go, you do have a podcast. I don't think I've mentioned it before why I've interviewed you. So quickly tell everybody about your show.
Sure. It's called Trip the Beltway Fantastic. I'm the host, but I often have like a carousel of friends talking about foreign policy, but in like the same framing that we're talking about today, just deeply skeptical of U.S. Foreign policy and the Warrior Party in general. And every other week, YouTube, Spotify, Substack.
I rarely miss an episode of the show, and everybody she interviews, a lot of great guests, including some people we've had on this show, like Michael Vallejos and James Carden. So definitely check that out. And thank you for your time today, Kelly.
Thank you.
Do you ever scroll through your camera roll and think, I should really do something with all of these?
Yeah, same. That's where Chatbooks comes in.
Right now, Chatbooks is offering something we've never done before. 12 monthly mini photo books for just $12, plus free shipping.
That's a full year of printed memories for less than you pay for 1 month of streaming. Go to chatbooks.com/get12 to claim your books now. No stress, no frustrating software. Just pick your photos, and the Chatbooks app does the rest. Printed photos have been proven to boost connection and belonging, and we think everyone deserves that. So what are you waiting for? Go to chatbooks.com/get12. That's chatbooks.com/get12 now, and get 12 monthly mini photo books for $12. But hurry, this deal won't last long.